You're listening to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition on Siren Radio. Congratulations. You've got great taste.
Travel. We all enjoy travel, or most of us, should we say, enjoy travel. But what about sustainable travel? Certainly sustainable tourism has been a critical aspect of our thoughts post-pandemic and indeed even pre-pandemic. So how do we actually assess this notion of how we can save money and be more sustainable as we head into the summer area? Well, who better to speak to than actually the awesome consumer journalist and indeed television presenter extraordinaire? It's the fabulous Kate Quilton. How are you, Kate?
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much. What a lovely introduction. How are you doing?
Well, it's great to connect with your good self, Kate, and fascinated in terms of this whole question about travel and so on. So how can we actually be more sustainable and budget savvy in the next few months?
Well, good question. Very good question. I mean, there are lots of ways to do this. I mean, for starters, if you can, travel out of peak season. If at all possible, you'll see a vast improvement in prices and you will save money. Also, if sustainability is important to you, which, as Booking.com found out from their research, is increasingly important to people that are traveling, 64% of people are saying that sustainability is high on their agenda and they want to travel more sustainably. When you're booking your accommodation, you can go to Booking.com and they've launched a travel sustainable badge. So you'll see basically any property that has been accredited as being sustainable, it will have a little green badge at the top. And it's also possible when you search, you just toggle a little filter on. And so you'll only be presented with those travel sustainable properties if that is what you're interested in. And it's brilliant, really, because there's not really a global yardstick that exists out there like that. And so, you know, it's a yardstick that you can trust.
And Kate, over the last few years, we've heard a great deal about greenwashing, companies who actually will put stuff out there and pretend to be green and sorted out when actually they're anything but. So for the point of view of people who are listening to this and saying, oh, yeah, it's all fine, but, you know, it's all very well Kate and Booking.com saying this particular side of things there. But how do we trust these things? I mean, how do we actually get that? Is there a kind of seal of approval? Is it a case of, well, if Kate Quilton says it's good, it must be?
Well, I can tell you something for sure, that this Travel Sustainable badge is really that. I mean, it's really trying to apply the same yardstick across. At the minute, 500,000 properties globally have been awarded with it. And it's a badge you can trust. You know, Booking.com carefully measure each property against very specific criteria. And so within that badge, there are actually tiers as well, and properties can achieve tier one, tier two, or if they're super eco and their credentials are really brilliant, then they will achieve a tier three. So it is a yardstick you can trust. And it's brilliant, really, because nothing else really exists kind of out there like it, really.
Like a kite mark for travel, sustainability and tourism, which is always good.
Exactly that.
Let's look a little bit more at this Booking.com survey. Were you surprised that three-fifths of travellers say that they are stuck between saving money on their holidays versus prioritising their concerns about sustainability? Was that something which surprised you? Did you think, yeah, okay, we kind of got that sense in any case?
Yeah, I mean, not surprising at all. I mean, I think for everyone right now, you know, everyone really is probably shocked every time they go to the supermarket. I know for one I am, you know, and I buy a weekly shop and I think, wow, okay, that's gone up again, you know. And so when you're existing and all your fundamentals are kind of on the increase, food, energy, etc., then of course you're going to be thinking about, oh, well, I'm not sure if I can still afford to go on holiday, is sustainability going to add an extra cost? And I think what is great about really drilling down and assessing all of these different properties globally is that it gives you the tools at home to really budget and make sustainable choices. You know, you can find accommodation wherever you're going and you can yourself compare, okay, well, look, this travel sustainable property here is actually pretty much the same price as something here or whatever, you know. So I think it's brilliant in terms of it gives you the tool to kind of make that choice and therefore spend your budget as you want to spend it.
And choice obviously is important. Kate, just one quick question in terms of what Manchester introduced this year, i.e. tourism tax. I think Wales are considering a tourism tax as well, Scotland a tourism tax as well. Do you think that's a good idea, or do you think, whoa, hang on a minute here, if we're encouraging tourists to actually travel, slapping on a tourism tax is going to be a whole different issue?
It's tricky. I mean, I guess it's something that we haven't seen before really in the UK, and new ideas can be challenging, but it is useful to remember that, you know, when you do travel, say when you visit a national park and you might pay for entry, you know, arguably that's kind of a form of tourism tax. You know, I think you might be kind of paying it around the world, but not quite sure exactly, that's what it is, you know. So this is just maybe a different shape of that, and let's just see how it plays out, because it might really, really benefit those tourism centres. And at the end of the day, in order to travel sustainably, we've got to pay for it, you know. You've got to kind of chip in. And so, you know, when people ask me for kind of tips about how to travel sustainably, you know, I always say, look, get out there and visit national parks, visit protected areas, plough your money into those, because they are ultimately gonna preserve them for future generations. So it's important to acknowledge that all of these things are an absolute privilege to visit and enjoy, and so it's important to put our hand in our pocket.
For folk who wish to find out more about the survey, presumably booking.com is the best place to go to. Is that right?
Absolutely. Head there. Thank you very much.
And we've got to ask the other question, basically, Kate. How do people actually follow your fantastic work as a consumer journalist, etc.? Are you on the socials? Is there a way in which people can actually keep updated with Kate Quilton on the road?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Follow me. I'm just at Kate Quilton everywhere. All the usuals, Twitter,
There we are.
Instagram, etc. Thank you
Ideal.
so
Kate Quilton
much.
everywhere. Kate Quilton, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on, and happy holidays, Kate.
You too. Thank you so much.
7 years of age. Yes, an important and significant milestone. Apparently, 7-year-old children are the most likely to refuse the clothing choices made by their parents and have their own views on fashion and their style. So, how do we actually cope with keeping up with the trends and indeed addressing the challenges of 7 to 12-year-olds effectively choosing their own clothes? Well, we're delighted to welcome to the program to share her thoughts on this particular aspect, fashion expert and indeed head of children's wear at John Lewis. That's the wonderful Katie Jordan. How are you, Katie?
Thanks for letting me join, Alex. I'm well, thank you.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self. And first of all, were you surprised about this? Is it a case of, well, I'm surprised it was as old as 7. I thought most people actually started making their fashion choices when they were 4.
Well, I've got a 4-year-old, so yes, I can tell you it was a slight surprise to me that it was as late as 7. But no, it has come down. It used to be 10 to 11-year-olds, and we. You know, this survey that we did has really kind of surprised us in a few ways, because it has really coined this kind of tweenager as a new age group, that kind of preteen, that has a much stronger opinion about how they want to look and creating their own personal identity at a younger age than was previously expected.
I mean, you use the term there, tweenager, which I can already hear proponents of keeping English a sacred language, etc., already sort of appalled at the use of the tweenager. It's bad enough that the teenager was actually emerging in the 1950s. Do you feel as though it's something which is going to be here to stay? And has it also been influenced by the likes of social media, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. I think look, this is it's ever evolving, isn't it? And times change. But we surveyed 1,000 parents of 7 to 12 year olds to get this data, and we learn a lot from it. We're always interested to know what our customers are thinking and what it's like to be a modern parent. And I think one of the most surprising things that we learned was that only 27% of parents have total control over their tween outfit choices. And over half of parents have bought clothes that their tweens refuse to wear. Now, for us as a retailer, obviously that's really important to know, because we want to appeal to that parent and to that that teenager. So making sure that we have the relevant collections, the relevant styles, and the relevant brands is very important. And being able to communicate with those teenagers and tweenagers that want to shop for themselves.
Over three quarters of parents said that their children's friends were the biggest influence on their child's clothing choices. What about influences in terms of pop stars and such like? Because I seem to recall as a child that, you know, had I had my way, I probably would have been dressed as Robin the Boy Wonder at certain times, which would not have been a good choice in any way, shape or form.
Thank God you're there. Your parents were there to intervene, perhaps. But
exactly.
I think it's true. The biggest influence is definitely peers at the moment. So guys want to dress like their friends. Beside that, social media is a really important influence. So we found YouTube, TikTok, other social media is really important for the kids in creating what we consider to be their own sense of identity and style. So that's where they're getting their influences. And I guess that's the biggest change, really, is that, you know, when I was growing up, we didn't have that. You know, you had sort of children's TV that was influencing me, but you know, I wasn't championing to dress like someone from a broom cupboard. But you know, it's a slightly different world we live in now, and I think helping parents navigate through what is a minefield, I think, of influence that they're getting from social media and from, you know, other kids these days.
Presumably, most of the tweenagers between 7 and 12 will be in full-time education. That obviously brings into bear the school uniform and, of course, the non-uniform days and so on. Do you feel that actually when it comes to something along those lines that actually, yeah, they really want to be seen as cool and it's almost important they have their own designer approach when they do have a non-uniform day, for instance?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And there is, you know, there's definitely a resurgence of, you know, younger kids being really into brands and identifying in brands, especially in sportswear. You know, for that reason, we've really upped our intake of brands in John Lewis. We used to be very own brand focused in the past, and we've introduced something like 70 brands over the past year, 10 of which are new for spring summer, and that really enables kids to kind of identify if they're really into a sports brand or into the lifestyle brands, that they can really get behind those brands and kind of help form their identity through that. But I think, you know, it's true that that the influence on kids is different today than it used to be in so many different ways. And I think the challenge for parents is not just around whether they can build an appropriate outfit for their kids that they'll want to wear, but whether, as you say, you know, they're going to want to wear it and they're going to want to get behind the brands that their parents want them to wear as well.
You mentioned, Katie, you've got a four-year-old. Are you looking forward to the next 3 years in which you can actually start saying, well, you know, in a few years from now, you can actually just decide whether you want those leopard skin pants or not?
It's already happened for me. My kid is already refusing. She tells me what she wants to wear, and even clothes that I've shopped with her, she now tells me she doesn't want a puffy sleeve, mummy. And that's the real challenge. I think for us, you know, being on top of the latest trends and what we think is going to be appealing for kids is super important. And, you know, we introduced a new design director last year to the business, and she has an impeccable taste level. And she's brought with her for this spring this kind of fun, cool 90s inspired collection that we think will really appeal to that tweenager, that older kid. So think sort of oversized hoodies, wide leg cargo pants, tie dye. And actually, you know, that collection does go down to, you know, an age 6 or 7 in some cases. And we've seen the uptick in that, you know, in terms of sales, that, you know, we're definitely seeing that penetrate. So I don't think it's a case that my kid is going to necessarily be waiting till they're 7 years old. I can already feel it. And I think parents out there will identify with that too.
Well, I frequently say parents very difficult to bring into the world, but that's a by the by. Finally, Katie, where can people actually locate more information about children's wear at John Lewis and indeed this particular survey?
Well, coming to our branches, if you're near, and if you're not, go into johnlewis.com where you'll see the landing page absolutely taken over by kids. It's our focus at the moment, and where you will be able to navigate separately by age range for the first time. So we've got a teen hub, we've got a brand hub. And so whether it's a parent shopping for their kids or the kids shopping for themselves, they should be inspired by what they see there online.
And have you ever found yourself, Katie, actually manifesting characteristics of your own parents when you sort of suddenly realize I'm becoming my mother now in saying these exactly same words?
Oh, man. If my mother is listening to this, she'll be laughing out loud. But yes, every single day, Alex, every single day I manifest my mother. And I'm sure lots of other people, more of your listeners will be doing the same. Let's see if that will be the same thing for my daughter to go through when she grows up as well.
Well, there you go. Katie Jordan, fashion expert. And I'm sure a tweenager at heart. And head of children's wear at John Lewis. Huge thanks. Take care now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, we all like to think that we're financially savvy, but are we? Well, it does seem that many adults are saying that it's never been more important to be financially savvy due to, of course, the inevitable rise in the cost of living. So it's time to bring on board our super heroine when it comes to this issue. You know her, of course, because she's a legend in so many ways as a top journalist, financial expert, blogger extraordinaire. It's Iona Bain. How are you, Iona?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex.
Always good to connect with your good self. But let's look at this particular survey, which, of course, addresses a number of key issues, including the notion that baby boomers, i.e. those born between 1946 and 1964, are the most vigilant generation when it comes to ensuring they're getting the best rates available for their savings. Were you surprised, or did you think, well, it shows a certain level of maturity even before we start talking apps?
Yeah, well, this research from Santander UK has found lots of interesting differences between the generations when it comes to how they manage their finances. And they're not the differences that you maybe might anticipate. So, you know, a lot of research tends to show that younger people are more online, they're more digitally savvy, and the older generations tend to do things the good old fashioned way with pen and paper when it comes to budgeting. But actually, this research found that all the generations are embracing digital tools to navigate the cost of living and boost their financial savviness. In fact, 75% of adults say that digital tools help them to keep on top of their finances. And as you mentioned there, Alex, baby boomers are particularly interested in using technology to make sure they're getting the best possible rate on their savings. And that is the silver lining of this current cost of living crisis. As the Bank of England base rate goes up to try to combat inflation, that in turn will mean that banks and building societies will offer higher savings rates to their customers. And so there is that opportunity to get a little bit more of a reward for doing the right thing and stashing your cash away.
We've spoken in the past about ways to make some quick savings and effective savings, but it seems as though inertia still kicks in when it comes to making impulse purchases, letting annual repayments renew without searching for better prices, and indeed forgetting to cancel unused subscriptions. Are you disappointed? Are you feeling as though, why are they not listening to us?
No, not at all, Alex. I mean, I still make those mistakes. I think it is perfectly understandable. We all live very complicated, busy lives. And we're also spending much more of our time online. And, you know, it's never been easier to spend money, but sometimes it can be too easy. And with one-click purchases and auto-fill details on spending websites for your credit card, it means that, you know, you can take out a subscription and take on a new financial commitment in less time than it takes to make a cup of tea. And if that's the case, it's not surprising that so many of us, one in five of us, say that we're still forgetting to cancel those subscriptions. We're still letting those bills renew every year without, you know, searching for better prices. And you know, we're making those impulse purchases because we're human. And we all use spending sometimes to make ourselves feel better and to, you know, try to cheer ourselves up. It's very understandable. I guess what I would say is that, you know, it's important to identify what your financial Achilles heel is. You may, in fact, have more than one. I know I do. And keeping a spending diary will help you identify when you spend money, but also why you spend money, because there are emotional and practical reasons why we overspend. And once you start identifying those pressure points, you can take action vacation, and you can start to, you know, put alternative activities in place, you know, maybe delete those shopping apps off your phone that tempt you to overspend. You can get better organized so that you're not having to buy takeaway coffee and food. You know, these are some of the examples of things that people can do to try and, you know, get on top of some of those bad habits. But it's worth stressing that we all do them, I think. It's fair to say I certainly do.
Now, the research, as you mentioned, came out of Santander's work, but they also offer a free financial health check. Would you say that would be fairly important to avail yourself of, not only because it's free, but also because it makes sense to actually ensure that you have a professional pair of eyes who can effectively turn around and say, yeah, actually, maybe you can make savings here?
Well, I think knowledge is power, Alex. And I think the great thing about this financial health check, which I took yesterday, is that it simplifies a process that could be incredibly complicated for most people. And you know, I think most of us, when we're faced with a complicated, daunting task, we'll put it off. And the problem then is that we'll store up problems and we'll make it, you know, far more difficult for us to actually tackle issues as they come up. You know, they'll get bigger and bigger and bigger. Whereas with this financial health check, you can get a very clear idea right now of what's going on with your finances. So you can take decisions as to, you know, what you could be doing differently. And that's crucial because you can get to know your finances better than anyone, you know, and I can say to people, why not try this? Why not do that? But ultimately, you are in the best position to decide, you know, what changes you can make depending on your personality, the demands on your time, you know, your lifestyle. But you can only do that once you have a basic awareness of what's going on with your finances. And that's the great thing about the financial health check. It's sort of like if you're driving a car, but you don't have, you know, you can't see out of the front window and, you know, there are no rear view mirrors. There's no way of you seeing what's in front of you or what's behind you. You know, chances are you're going to crash that car sooner rather than later. So doing this financial health check means that you can see clearly in front of you're driving towards your destination and you know where you're going.
Spoke about the baby boomers effectively wanting to ensure they get the best rates available for saving. Interested to see that Generation Z or Generation Z, I know if you're American, would be most likely to monitor what's coming in and out of their accounts multiple times a day online. I mean, isn't that a little bit obsessive, Iona, when you don't just say step away from the screen?
Well, Gen Z are extremely adept online, and they are, you know, spending more time online, I think, than anybody. So it's not a surprise that they are also getting extremely comfortable with their digital banking, and that they are using tools to check, you know, what's coming in and going out of their accounts several times a day. And to be honest, you know, that may be a good idea if you are spending a lot, and if you are, you know, setting up lots of different payments to leave your accounts at different times, and if your finances are on the complicated side, then I definitely think it's better to be, you know, checking in with your finances more often and making sure that you understand what's going on. Obviously, you don't want to get to a point where you're over checking your accounts and being, you know, a little bit too vigilant about them. But, you know, I think I'm always going to advocate for people, you know, checking in with their finances more often. And I think, you know, it's up to individuals to decide, you know, what's healthy, you know, how many times a day they need to do that. But if it's helping them make better decisions, then I'm all for it.
And finally, the art of the haggle, the art of negotiation, Iona. I mean, I'm sure yes. You're an expert at this side of things here. but extraordinary to see that Londoners are 32% more likely to negotiate prices than those in the Northeast. Apparently up in the Northeast, we just, whatever, you know, we'll just have to pay it, shrug the shoulders, say, oh, well, that's the way it is. Were you surprised by that?
Well, that's the case when it comes to eating out, but it may be in other categories, Alex, that people up in the Northeast are much more emboldened to haggle. I think that, you know, we are seeing this comeback for haggling during the cost of living crisis, because people maybe are not so embarrassed to ask for a discount. Perhaps their attitude is, you know, what's the worst that could happen? You know, it's a bit like asking somebody out on a date. If they say no, well, you know, it's no skin off my nose. Hey, you know, might as well go for it, give it a go. And so I think that's what more and more people are thinking. And also after the pandemic as well, I think that people realize that they've got very little to lose in terms of trying to get value for money at all times. So yeah, we're seeing people negotiate on prices for all sorts of things, clothes, car insurance, entry to a nightclub. That was one that interested me because I would never, ever have the confidence to be
given free entry in any case, as a matter of course.
Trust me, Alex, I wouldn't. I'd struggle to get in because I'm that tragically uncool. But I need to go to the nightclubs where you are. Maybe I'll have a bit more luck.
Not a problem. Finally, where can people actually find out details about this Santander research, Iona?
So Santander's online financial support and digital tools, including their financial health check and budget calculator, all available online and crucially available for anybody to use, not just Santander's customers. So you can search for Santander's financial support tools and their support pages to get more information.
And for the growing band of Iona Bain followers, who I think we're referring to as Bainettes these days, or Bainies, how can they locate your good self online?
Well, all Bainettes can tune in on Monday mornings when I'm on BBC Morning Live. And also they can find me on Twitter at Iona Young Money and on Instagram at Iona J Bain.
Fantastic. We'll wrap up with those two final questions. I think you know what they are. Have you had a recently interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today, Iona?
Interesting Zoomer. Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
Yeah, has it been okay for you? It's our customer satisfaction thing, basically.
Customer satisfaction. Oh, 11 out of 10, as always, Alex. Always. Oh,
fantastic. And therefore, I take it you'll be happy to come back and return in the not too distant future and maybe check out some of the Lincoln nightclubs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was in Lincoln not that long ago, actually, but I didn't have the chance to check out the nightlife. So,
Nor indeed the Siren Radio studios. I'm saddened, Iona, but never mind. We need to.
That's where my night will start. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Iona, take care. All the very best and keep on keeping
Thank
on.
You.
Okay. Well, I have to say I did watch Winnie the Pooh, Blunder the Honey, not once, but twice over the last couple of days. And indeed, Julie actually met up with most of the cast, including Craig David Dowsett, who played indeed the eponymous Winnie the Pooh, serial killer. And of course, Natasha Tassini and Maria Taylor, who were in Winnie the Pooh, Blunder the Honey. Even though I thought the cast were wonderful, Maria, Natasha and Craig, fantastic stuff there. Can I go beyond 4 out of 10? I fully anticipate many people, including Mark Commode, saying it's a 1 out of 10 at best. Richard, is Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, a movie that in these coronation pre-days that we're just beginning to work through, is it one that appeals to you in the slightest, seeing, of course, this beloved character of A.A. Milne turning out to be, together with Piglet, quite frankly, a psychotic serial killer in the same way as Leatherface from Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Freddy Krueger from, of course, the Nightmare on Elm Street series and indeed the Halloween Mask Killer as well. Is it one that you think, this is what King Charles would want? This is what he'd actually want us to do as a nation, to gather behind Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey?
Alex, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but the answer is absolutely not.
I thought that was the case, which is one of the reasons why we may be joined by Oliver Stanley, who indeed also has seen the movie as yet, and may actually have one or two things to say about it. But we are, of course, approaching that time where the world's thoughts turn to the most significant aspect of May, which is, of course, as I'm sure you're aware, Richard, the Eurovision Song Contest to be held in Liverpool. It's one of the key classic lines in which people should be going through that. It's possibly one of the reasons why, Jessica from Dublin and indeed maybe Sarah Huntley will be a little bit tardy in terms of joining us. But I think there's something else that's taking place as well that involves the former Battenbergs, now Windsor family, and indeed somebody else who might have one or two things there. Although I gather that there's still question marks about the Sussexes, feeling as though, once again, the Sussex family are being given the short end of the stick, the brown end of the stick, shall we say, insofar as they're getting second billing to, of course, the Cambridges. I mean, surely a challenge that is one of the reasons that's being put forward is, you know, they weren't happy with the reply King Charles actually gave in terms of Meghan's concerns about racist comments made by a named member of the royal family. And so that's the reason only Harry is making the journey over for a brief cameo appearance at the coronation.
Yes, it does seem that way. And I have to say, I'm not sure I was surprised. I mean, it was surprising the Telegraph had the so-called scoop that Meghan wrote after the Oprah interview regarding the alleged racism and this comment to the then Prince of Wales. He apparently didn't reply in a way she thought satisfactory, but it's become a little bit of a circus in this respect. I mean, what will they do next? What will she do? Or say, will there be a party for Ashley for the fourth birthday of the young prince? I mean, Archie. I mean, I frankly, what we've seen this week, the variety of polls, it does, as always, leading up to these big events, lead one to ask, how interested are the public? What will be the level of enthusiasm or turnout or whatever? I mean, you can read these polls in more or less any way you choose because it's the way the question's put. It's rather like the fact that so many, question monarchy versus republic. And in this, for the 18 to 24 year old group, it is a bit concerning for all those who have my points of view at the moment. But the point being that if you ask the simple question, are you disillusioned with the royals? And your answer is yes. It doesn't necessarily mean you'd vote for a republic.
I have to just sort of point out present that the reason we're getting those railway announcements is because Sarah Huntley, bless her, is currently actually listening to us from a transit routine. Worry not, because what I'll actually do with respect to Sarah is I shall actually just mute her momentarily. It's not that I'm muting Sarah. It's just obviously we don't necessarily want to have Richard's wonderful erudite comments framed with respect to the train announcements from Sarah's journey back to London. So it's all done now, Richard. Worry not.
On the subject of a journey, I mean, a journey that I would suggest that many would enjoy would be one to Westminster Abbey. It closes on the 25th, so, I mean, it's unlikely now. It's probably completely full. But it is very interesting, firstly, to see the setting, church going back to Edward the Confessor. It's over 1,000 years. The first king crowned there, William the First, in 1066, which, of course, is the date we all know. And subsequently, I mean, Charles will be the 40th to be crowned. There was one joint crowning as William.
And possibly the last, of course, Richard.
I suspect very strongly not, Alex. Pretty certain that we're going to see King William and Queen Catherine. And I would be amazed. There are these polls, and you get a variety of views on that particular topic. What impressed me is the Abbey is fantastic, and it really, really is interesting. Is the treasures of the Westminster Abbey and the Queen's Diamond Jubilee galleries, and also the view you get looking down the choir, the altar, the extraordinary numbers of statues to so many famous figures and so on. You get a fabulous bird's eye view of the Abbey from there, and it really is impressive. And then there's the Liber Regalis, which was the order of the coronation at the time of Richard II. And the sacred part of it has actually changed very, very little, the ritual, since then. There's also the marriage license of William and Catherine. There are a variety of funeral effigies in the days when they used to, when a monarch died, they did the likeness. So you can see Queen Anne or Elizabeth I. And I mean, it really is fascinating. The chair, King Edward's chair, which was the dates from Edward I. King Edward's chair is going to be used in the coronation ceremony because it's on the sitting on this that the king is crowned and the stone of Scone is beneath. That is no longer in the galleries, but it is worth at a future month, if anyone is in London and would like to see a really interesting aspect of Westminster Abbey, to go to the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Galleries. You just go up in the lift and you find very few people there, where there are thousands packing different parts of the Abbey to see the Royal Tombs, Poets' Corner, even David Hockney's new window, I have to say, that I didn't think was successful, but it is fabulous. And you've got the Henry the Seventh Chapel, which is the chapel of the Order of the Bath, an order founded in 1725. And one of the best known, well, the best known photograph featuring it was one Cecil Beaton took of the Queen. This was after she was crowned, and he did a mock-up of the banners of the order. And it looked fabulous. So it really, really was very, very interesting to have a walk around. And also, as I say, go to the galleries, and there's an exhibition called Coronation, which gives a sort of sketch for easily available, you know, which you could easily access for ordinary people who obviously would find parts of this ceremony, the recognition, investiture.
But Richard, is it for the ordinary people? I mean, surely, you know, that's not what the likes of kings and such, they should be there as part of the ordinary people, should they? Surely.
I think that the essential aspect of monarchy, as you well know, Alex, is a symbol of national unity, and that involves all people of all types. Regarding the word or the phrase ordinary people, it simply means that it's accessible to an average person who wouldn't be, for example, aware necessarily that when William I was crowned, this was in Westminster Abbey, the Normans thought that the shouts of acclamation by the Saxons were in fact some form of revolt, and so there were pillage occurred, or indeed that
Richard, we know the reason why they weren't given quiche. That's the key point. If only they'd actually had some quiche, then, you know, that coronation quiche would have made all the difference. Isn't that right, Cathy Mansour? You know, surely quiche is at the heart of this whole challenge.
Yes.
Yeah. And it has to be pointed out, for the first time ever since we started doing these whole things, Cathy and myself are in the same building at the University of Lincoln, I in my office, Cathy in another part of the Alfred Tennyson building, because that's the way things have panned out these days. Sarah has now actually lost the link entirely, and Jessica Burtis is trying to reach us from Dublin. But Natasha's with us. Natasha, do you think that coronation quiche is going to go down very well with some Vegemite sandwiches in Australia as we celebrate King Charles' accession? Well, not accession, coronation.
I think there'll be some people who'd give it a good go. Yeah, why not? They like a good pastry out here. As long as it's done well, I can't see why they wouldn't. I'm not sure I've seen a lot of celebrations themselves taking place or any sort of parties or anything being arranged. That's not to say people aren't having family parties.
I mean, that's to be saved for when the Republic finally occurs, basically. That's what the celebrations are for. There'll be massive celebrations then.
I don't know. It's one of those hard ones. As I say, the Prime Minister himself has a Republican tendencies, so it makes it a little bit politically interesting. I think there's a lot of love, as I say, for William. As I've mentioned before on the show, that William and Kate have a lot of following and a lot of support out here. I'm not, and the Queen, rest her soul, also did. I'm not sure how popular Charles is, so that might be why it's been a little bit dampened. But I don't know. I don't believe a lot of the schools are doing too much either out here, which is quite strange because normally they are quite good at that. So I don't know if that's just everything's just been mixed up because we've got Anzac Day going off this week as well. So I think a lot of the focus has been on
Anzac. It was World Day basically yesterday. It's William Shakespeare's birthday. It's London Marathon Day. Richard, I'm surprised actually you're joining us because normally you've got your Converse All-Star shoes out and you're dressed as a giant beef eater running the London Marathon. That not taking place this year?
I'm sorry, Alex, you know, it's too much work in other areas.
Honestly, the beasts of the whole thing, which neatly segues us into your first movie review, which has subtitles, not just for the hard of hearing, but also for a whole range of other factors. Richard, talk us through Beasts, please.
The Beasts, yes. This is a film that will stay with you. It is an insight into a nightmare, but also into the very, very darker aspects of the human spirit when there is a backstory, which is rather well handled too in this film. So we get to understand both the obvious, its obvious heroes and also its villains. It's a Spanish film directed by Rodrigo Sorogoyen, and it's loosely inspired by real events that took place about a decade or so ago for over a period of years. Meet a French couple, Antoine, played by Denis Menochet, and Olga, played by Marina Foy. They settle in a small village. They grow eco-friendly crops, and they intend to rehabilitate abandoned properties. But they fall out badly with their neighbors, the pretty brutal character called Zan, who is a bully and is a danger, and Loren, his brother, who's handicapped but also very hostile. And this, they for falling out of the because they object to the sale of a land, parts of land in this village, to a wind energy company, because his neighbors and the rest of the village want a chance to move away from something that's decaying, whereas they want to try and help it to grow and prosper. Now, it is absolutely fascinating, this, because on the one hand, you've got this the fact that the wind turbines are being put up and so forth. The movie is eco-friendly because you have its heroes. Its heroes, Antoine and Olga, who are handling their soil, some of it they're using, some of it they're letting go wild, and so forth. You've got some extremely good performances, but most of all, this is a mood piece. Its atmosphere is absolutely scintillating, because what happens? There is provocation after provocation. The local gendarmes don't want to know anything about it, or the Garda Civil, should I say, and there's a very, very menacing character in Zan, played by Luis Sequeira, who in fact seems to dominate the village. And the fact that, for example, batteries are found in their well ruins their tomato crop. And the whole film is starting to lead towards conclusions that, I mean, one has to be a sort of semi-spoiler here. Antoine disappears. Now, it's perfectly obvious what's happened to him, because we do see, and indeed the poster for this movie is almost, I mean, it's one of the most ferocious posters I've ever seen. The scene itself is terrifying. The poster haunts you. This is a movie that haunts you, because atmospherically, I mean, visually, it's absolutely brilliant. What happens, though, is that Olga stays on and constantly looking for where her husband's body, she believes, is buried. And her daughter, Marie, played by Marie Calom, urges her, pleads with her to move away, because after all, this is a patriarchy. It's a brutal patriarchy. And Olga is alone. And next door to her, almost certainly, are her husband's murderers. What does she do? Why does she do it? And what is the conclusion of her staying on? I can only say that I was just gripped by the excellence of everyone's performance here. I mean, Denis Menochet has always had a strong presence, and certainly that comes across. Marina Foy as well as Olga, all of them excellent. But I was absolutely gripped from start to finish by this film. I have allowed a spoiler or two to get out, simply because it's so obvious from the poster, and it's not something that the movie hides. On the contrary, what's happened to her husband shows only too obviously the deep love there was between them, but also it shows the sinister nature of the village patriarchy and the way a couple of individuals can turn human life into an absolute hell. Absolutely riveting.
Like Charles and Camilla, basically.
Oh, took the words out of my mouth, Alex.
One thing that's maybe it's just me, because I haven't actually seen this particular one as yet, but it struck me as having slight echoes of the classic from the 1980s, Jean de Florette and Manon des Sources. Or is that a case of no, that's a much milder version of what the French did as opposed to what Spanish are doing here?
I think it's rather a good panel, actually. Yes, I think that, I mean, both of them rural settings, both of them you've got someone wanting to change things, and you've also got, and it's a movie partly about the way things, certain things are unchanging, or perhaps they do change climactically. Wait and see.
Well,
it,
yes, I think so. I mean, Natasha Wont, and I mean, clearly Gerard Depardieu, probably much more popular than King Charles will ever be in Australia. You've probably never seen Jean de Florette, or indeed Manon des Sources, but what about The Beasts?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the movie poster. I just found it that Richard mentioned. Yeah, that's quite a statement piece, isn't it, really? That pretty much, yeah, says it all. Interesting to hear Richard talking there. I watched the trailer, and they did a really good job of not giving anything away. I mean, I had no flipping clue what was going on for the entirety of the trailer, so I'm very glad that I got to listen to Richard's description, because going on the trailer alone, it probably would have been a meh, no from me.
It's very irritating when the trailer doesn't give everything away about the movie. I prefer to see everything about the movie literally in a 2 or 3 minute trailer. I know Richard secretly likes that as well, but...
No, yeah, both ends of the spectrum. There's got to be a middle ground. Middle grounds are nice. Like, you don't want to know everything, but you do need to have some, like, medium of what the plot is. And I feel like the trailer wasn't great with that. So, no, based on Richard's description, I'm very interested in this movie. And I think it sounds, yeah, I think it sounds intriguing. I think there's a lot of people, maybe particularly of, like, mine and Jess and Kathy's generation, that could probably maybe take from that as well in terms of the whole... being in a situation where there are people who don't want things to change and then wanting to change things for the better. And I think generationally there's a lot that maybe we could maybe connect with that. So no, interesting. I would actually now want to see this movie based on what Richard has told me.
Well, certainly if you want to actually access movies or narratives, then when others might fail to access Continuum for a variety of reasons, Jessica Burtis can succeed, thank the Lord, and Resonance Rewind can progress as well. But Jessica, from your own perspective, what about Beasts? Is this something which you think, well, I mean, rural Ireland and North Carolina is a bit rural as well, so maybe I should sort of explore this?
Yeah, maybe I should thematically. I mean, I think Richard has made me curious. It seems very dramatic. And I've been needing some new movie to really jump into. I after Dungeons and Dragons, it's made me want to go back to watching movies. So I think I would see this.
Yeah, interesting that Dungeons and Dragons could persuade you to go and see Beasts. It's extraordinary. I mean, different kind of beasts, obviously dragons, perhaps not appearing in the Spanish version. Kathy Manso, from somewhere in the Alfred Tennyson Building in Lincoln, your thoughts, please.
Yeah, no, actually this got brought up in my family because it has the background is in Spain, near a village where my family's from. So this has been like, we've all been very excited because we're just kind of curious, but I love that I had to be the one who broke it to my family being like, but do you know that it's the vibe of the movie? I guess is the, I don't exactly want them going into thinking that it's
just look at the poster. Like, just look at the poster.
The poster, exactly. So, but yeah, I definitely want to see this. I'm interested. This, exactly as Natasha was saying earlier, it is very much kind of our generation will definitely kind of look at this in a bit of a similar way, I think, to say. But yeah, I'm down. I'm ready to go.
Some folk might say that the best thing about No Time to Die, of course, was Daniel Craig's partner, Lee Seydoux. She emerges as a poignant drama directed by Mia Hansen, Mia Hansen-Løve, to be precise. One Fine Morning. Would you like to take us through One Fine Morning, please, Richard?
Yes, Alex. One Fine Morning, Mia Hansen-Løve directs and directs terribly well. On the one hand, this is a romantic drama. On the other hand, there's also something that is deeply disturbing about this movie. It is a movie about love, but not only romantic love, but as at the center of a very, very deep love between a daughter and a father who is suffering from a neurodegenerative disease. And the way this is combined, I thought, was extremely sensitive. I agree totally with what Alex said about the best thing in No Time to Die being Léo Seydoux. Indeed, I...
Richard, this is unbelievable. Two things we've agreed on Jean de Florette, Manon des Sources, and now, of course, we actually have No as a standard. Perhaps I'm feeling ill being back in Lincoln.
Alex, I will try and make sure it doesn't happen again. But yes, you are quite correct. I mean, seeing No Time to Die again was not wise. Léo Seydoux was indeed the best thing in it. Well, with a nod to Daniel Craig, of course. But
very kind of you, Richard. Yes, I appreciate that.
I thought he would, after all. But nonetheless, Sandra. Meet Sandra. Sandra Kiesler, played by Léo Seydoux, a widow with a young daughter, Lynn. She works as an interpreter and she cares for her father, a former highly regarded academic who still lives for his reading, such as he was able to do. But unfortunately, his library is of little use. He can't see now and is unable also to cope in his own apartment. I mean, she is helped by her mother, Francois, who is divorced, her father, Georg. And a lot of this film is in several parts of it, the terrors of being old, how you are moved from a hospital to a care home, a state care home, then to a private care home, and how this is handled. It's very, very sensitively intercut with a romance between Sandra and Clement, played by Pascal Gregory, who is a married chemical cosmologist. He's married with a son, but also he's in Paris after having gone to the North Pole and is they're mutually attracted. It is a love story which plays out in one way or another. No spoilers here. But what is obvious is that her father, Georg, is unable to cope. What happens to him? What happens to her with her affair with Clement, and what commitment has he actually got? Is it what he says or is it less? And also, it's fascinating. You've got, again, both of these movies visually absolutely extraordinary, really stunning scenes in Paris, scenes outside Paris. It's characters deeply, deeply in love and indifferent with different ways. And when someone is slipping away from you and doesn't recognize you, and indeed believes that you're his girlfriend or might, well, that's all he wants. I mean, you can see how deeply hurt a sensitive person is by this. And the film takes it a stage further, which I won't reveal, actually quoting in voiceovers from from literature and poetry on the subject of what might or should happen if someone is at a stage where they simply cannot cope in any sort of way as an acceptable life.
Richard, one can't just take them out and shoot them, Richard. You know, it's important. You know, we're not that far away ourselves. We don't want to be taken out and shot. I mean, I thought that might have occurred yesterday when I was with Kathy at the Sci-Fi Scarborough event, but, you know, we have to carry on.
An interesting point, Alex. I'm unsure that this is what the film suggests, but I do recommend this. Pascal Gregory is amazing as Georg, her father. Nicole Garcia as Francois, her mother. It's Léo Seydoux's film. It's a mood piece. It's a beautiful, sensitive, very, very absorbing performance. And as Clement, Pascal Gregory is very well cast. No, it's a very fine film, but it is also challenging. I haven't, there is, so to speak, a message in the film, which I think people might just would discover when they see it, that I haven't dwelt on, but touched on. So again, greatly recommended.
Cathy Manso, as you are now officially one degree of separation away from Idris Elba, having met Derek Dermot Crowley yesterday, and indeed actually managed to work out the correct way to actually position Jessica Burtis's avatar, Jessie, on a Dalek, would you like to have anything you had about One Fine Day?
One fine morning, Alex. So yes.
Well, one fine morning. I don't know. Entirely different movie. One fine day. One fine morning. You see, I'm clearly too ancient on this side of things. I should be taken out forthwith.
Brutal. What a brutal morning. Oh man. No. yes, I do. Okay, I have mixed feelings, which is good because I think Richard described this beautifully, and it sounds like a beautiful story, but it also sounds like a story where I'm going to be crying the whole time. And a lot of it, I'm sure, will be happy tears, but a lot of it will be very sad tears. And I think this is one of those films where I would be happy to watch it in the comfort and safety of my home with a very warm blanket.
So, and some cookies, perhaps.
Perhaps, yes. That for some reason, Alex doesn't want. Okay, this is a whole other thing, and I don't mean to bring this in, but if I offered you cookies to the group, would you?
You left them in the car, Kathy. You left them in the car. So obviously, I'm thinking, well, you obviously just want to have those cookies back. So I return the cookies in full, all four.
Yeah, I remind you, Alex, that the mutiny on the Bounty finally occurred because of the theft of coconuts. And
it's my thoughts exactly. Yeah, you know, yeah. Very delicate world here, you know. Anyway, so one fine morning, possibly, but more in a domestic situation for yourself, Kathy.
Yes.
Marvellous. Jessica, you might have felt the positive power of Kathy and myself yesterday when we were interviewing Davros and indeed the Sixth Doctor Who and, of course, Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, saying, where do we position Jessica's avatar here? What about yourself and One Fine Morning?
I just have to say, I love the range there within that whole sentence of all the people you were interviewing. That was quite the array. I think that I also agree with Kathy. This sounds like a movie that would be very emotional, very cathartic probably, and a movie that I will not be watching while doing exams. I think I need to be in a particular mindset to watch this. So I think later, once there's a bit more sunshine, then I'll watch it.
Yeah. And Natasha Wanton, as somebody who, when you go on Location Report, certainly the New York Book Festival would actually look for sword fighting and all sorts of things simply because there were no cookies available. Would you go and see One Fine Morning?
I'd certainly take up the offer of cookies. I'm not sure how I feel about this movie. I have mixed feelings. The story looks like it would be very thoughtful and very well sort of pieced together. You get the themes of the love, you get the themes of the sort of internal strife of the main character. I'm just not sure how I would connect with the main character in certain elements of it from what I was seeing in the trailer, but it would be interesting to see. I'm not sure if I come away liking her or not, but I would probably give it a go. But like the others, I'd probably do it in the comfort of my own house. Just out of interest, Richard, your scores for this evening for the two movies, what were those?
Yes. In fact, I was struggling with that very thought because definitely The Beast gets 10 and One Fine Morning, I suppose, because it's maybe a little on the alongside, perhaps ought to get 9, but I mean, I'm tempted to give them both 10. They're both beautifully handled visually. It's just what you want to see in a film, and I mean the direction, and these performances, they are so good.